here today. You see, the police, they came and they took him for a ride. You see, he would not fight in that war, you know, the one they call the war against the poor. And he would not bow down to genocide. We will not bow down. We will not bow down. We will not bow down to genocide. There was a preacher in Harlem who had two children. Both of them died within 1 year because he couldn't get any heat in his tenement during wintertime. Reverend McPhailin's kids didn't get very old.
Uhuru and welcome to Reparations in Action, sponsored by the African People's Solidarity Committee. We want to thank the African People's Socialist Party for letting us have this show on Uhuru Radio, and just let everybody know that the African People's Solidarity Committee is an organization working under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party, which leads the Uhuru movement. Our work is to organize in the white community to win other white people, just like ourselves, to stand in solidarity with the struggle for African liberation that is a worldwide struggle of African people, and to stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples worldwide. My name is Penny Hess, and I'm here in the studio with Harris Daniels today. Uhuru, Harris.
Uhuru.
And we have a great show for you today. We're going to be talking to Lucia Laguna of Union de Barrio, the organization of Mexican people organizing for the liberation of Mexican people, indigenous people, and they are based in California. And we're going to be talking about the whole question of the genocide of the indigenous people as we move into these imperialist holidays, Thanksgiving, and we just had Columbus Day last year, which are celebrations of genocide. And we recognize that this country and the system is built on the enslavement of African people and on the genocide of the indigenous people, and the theft of their land, and the fact that the indigenous people have an absolute unconditional right to this land. This land is stolen, this entire hemisphere, and it belongs to the indigenous people. So we want to welcome Lucia, and really happy to have you on the air today. Lucia, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Uhuru, and welcome.
Uhuru.
I want to let our listeners know that you can email us during this conversation at djdj@uhururadio.com. And before we start, I just wanted to let everybody know that Harris and I had the honor of being at the Black is Back Coalition mobilization yesterday in Washington, D.C., and a lot of the presentations from that mobilization have been being played this morning on Uhuru Radio, so if you had a chance to hear it, you would just be very thrilled, because it was an amazing mobilization of tremendous unity of the African community and just really exposing Obama as a neo-colonial face of white power today and calling for the end to U.S. imperialism and victory to African, Arab and indigenous peoples worldwide. So it was a powerful, powerful demonstration and rallies yesterday, and it's going to affect the whole way that movements are going. And it was also very interesting that there was nobody from the white left or anti-war movements there, and I think that's very telling about the opportunist nature of what is called the peace movement in this country. Instead of standing against imperialism, it's standing for imperialist peace rather than victory to the liberation of oppressed peoples. So I wanted to begin our show today with a presentation by Union de Barrio member Ron Goches, at University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. I believe it was in 1996. And it's a powerful presentation, and it really gives you a sense of what Unión del Barrio is about. And it also shows the closeness of the relationship between Unión del Barrio and the Uhuru movement in the way that they see the world and the struggle of indigenous and African and oppressed peoples. So let's start with that clip.
As a militante of Unión del Barrio, a revolutionary Mexican organization here, we understand what the camarada is saying. You're right, this is not just about Mexico. This is about a global struggle against imperialism and capitalism.
Yes.
But we know that all of that is happening in the context that where we now stand is stolen, occupied Mexico.
Yeah.
And the message that we bring is we want to bring a little bit of more of a revolutionary context to this. Why is it that these people, these frail, racist white people, want to keep us out of this country? It's not because simply the color of our skin. It's not simply because they just want to exploit us. Let me tell you why. Because on this planet right now, of 6 billion people, at the forefront of the revolutionary movement is the raza. When you go to Venezuela, when you go, we have the long history and example of our comandante, Fidel Castro Ruz. We got Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales, we got Brazil, Ecuador, you name it. We have nine left of center governments in Latin America right now. And they know something that one young Argentine called Che Guevara said. It was called the domino theory. And he knew that every single country would go revolutionary, one after the other, after the other, after the other. So what do they fear? They know that every single country, they know that we no longer will fall to these lies called borders. We know that a Salvadoran and a Guatemalan and a Nicaraguense and a Mexicano, there's no damn difference. We are all one people. So with that in mind, we see ourselves, all of us here, as the northern front of a Latin American revolutionary movement. More than 40 million of our people north of the Rio Grande. That means to them, there's 40 million potential revolutionaries north of the border, inside the belly of the beast. So when you think about why do they want to kick us, of all people, out, that's why. Because they know that we now know the truth. They know that now we are raza, we're professionals, we're educators, we are revolutionary students. What does that mean? We are not just a regular culture anymore. We're a culture of revolutionary spirit. And that's the fear. So with that being said, I want to leave you with this. As a revolutionary, and with revolutionary context, let's be clear about one thing. Our enemy is not the Minutemen. Quote me. Our enemy is not the Minutemen. Because the Minutemen are not the ones who have killed over 4,600 people at those borders. That our enemy is the same enemy as Hugo Chavez. That Hugo Chavez has. Our enemy is the same enemy that keeps Africa poor. Our enemy is the same enemy that keeps Asia poor. Our enemy is capitalism and imperialism. Okay? And I'll finish with this in respect to time. If we are serious about making change, if you are serious about making change, let me tell you, the struggle will go on for many more years after we leave UCLA. Reading a book or writing a book or teaching a class, that is not part of the movement. What you do 24 hours a day as a professional revolutionary, That is what is going to lead our people and our people to liberation. Que viva la raza.
Uhuru. Powerful presentation by Ron Gochez of Union de Barrio in 1996. Really expressing the spirit, que viva la raza, of the right of the indigenous people to this land and the struggle for the liberation of indigenous people. Lucia, welcome. Uhuru. Uhuru. I know you couldn't hear that just while we were playing it, but I think you said that you were there on that day. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, I was there, and I've also, you know, I've seen footage of it since that seems to be a favorite video of our enemies to pour out to everybody else.
Yes.
And that's actually a May of 2006.
May 2006.
Uhuru. Yeah, so it's recent, but not as recent as the people that are now distributing it are saying it is, because they're saying it has to do with the Arizona law and all this other stuff that just isn't true. This happened in UCLA in 2006, and it was actually because a leader of the Minutemen was going to go speak at UCLA.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so we went and we did a protest and a rally because it's a public university. It's funded with both federal and state taxes, plus it's obviously the tuition of many students that do not hold those views. And we just didn't feel that that was a space for hate, because at that point it isn't discourse, it's hate.
Uh-huh.
So that was our reason for protesting. And what ended up happening is the speaker never showed up because of our protest.
Okay,
so it was a small victory in that sense. And I know somewhere in the video, Ron makes references to these frail white people. He was referring to the entire, you know, Euro-American population. He was referring to the people that didn't show up.
Uhuru. Well,
so
I think it is...
That's another thing, yeah, taking out of context.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but I think that, it is true that white people live on the pedestal of this stolen land and on the enslavement of African people and on genocide and colonialism around the world. And I think it's important to challenge white people to take the correct stand and to stand in solidarity with the indigenous people.
So. No, definitely, and I'm sure something that you've also seen personally, that a lot of people, they're very willing to give lip service, but they're not actually willing to change anything that mm-hmm. challenges their comfort. And I think, you know, a lot of what Ron was pointing out historically is accurate, and that scares him because he's never seen it or heard it coming, especially from a very passionate and articulate, you know, brown man. That's scary to them, and I can see why if they're used to always just hearing the same story of history that has been so watered down and in some ways completely fabricated about how this nation was started, about how the Americas were founded. I mean, they leave out everything that is gruesome, and I also think that's one of the reasons why ethnic studies is really important, not only for the communities that it serves in terms of Asian American studies, Raza studies, Chicano studies, but also for the people that are not in those ethnic groups, especially for white people, so that they gain a multicultural understanding and really start to comprehend and accept what it is that we go through.
Uhuru, I agree with that. I think it's our responsibility as white people to understand the truth and understand not only what our ancestors did, but what we do by just being passive, by being complicit, by apathetic, you know, what that means. Because everything that we take for granted in our lives and for our children means that children around the world are starving, are suffering, and taking resources from them. And I think that to understand the real truth is key for any white person who wants to have a principled relationship with African and indigenous people. And we are, as we were talking about, we're in this season in the U.S. that has holidays celebrating the genocide of indigenous people. And you know, we have to really get to the truth about that. What does Thanksgiving mean? Thanksgiving is a holiday for thank you for us stealing your land. Thank you for us committing genocide against you. This is something that we have to really understand, that this country, I'd say Thanksgiving is probably one of the most popular favorite holidays, and this is about the genocide of the indigenous people. So I wanted to start out this interview with asking you, Lucia, to tell us a little bit about the history, about the truth, about the fact that open policy of genocide was carried out against the indigenous people for hundreds of years, and that white people participated in that as well.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, there is a few tidbits of truth in the history of what is commonly taught to children in schools about Thanksgiving, and that is that the indigenous people were very humanist, mm-hmm. that the indigenous people they encountered, in the sense that they weren't going to let these strangers starve. So when winter came around and the white people were not adapted to the environment, didn't know how to get food, didn't know where to find food or hunt, or, you know, just really basic things that the indigenous people knew that they had survived on. The indigenous people fed them from their own food reserves, which they would store in the ground. So they would dig it up and store food in the ground, and the white people saw where they were buried, where they were burying their food, or they were keeping their reserves for the whole winter. And they decided that it was absolutely okay to dig out the rest of their reserves and eat their food, basically, for the whole winter in a short period of time. This was food that was going to be for an entire population of Native people. It wasn't just for one or two families. And it's something that was a huge form of disrespect. It violated the indigenous people's trust even more, and it also helped to starve out a lot more people. So they were grateful for that, I guess. They were grateful for being able to find all this food that, for some reason, they thought was okay and it was theirs for their taking. And in the process, they starved millions, well, maybe not millions, but several families. And it really, you know, I don't think at that point they were thinking it's going to become a holiday, but it kind of became this romanticism of we broke bread with our Native brothers. They helped us. And of course, they don't tell the whole story mm-hmm. about what actually happened, and they made it into some nice holiday. How it was turned into a holiday, I'm still not 100% sure how anyone could have really gotten on board on that. But it really is, I really do find it to be a very insulting celebration. Mm-hmm. And I wish, you know, I could convince the rest of my family, but it's not that easy.
Right. Well, yeah, this is true, and I agree with you that it was the Native people, it was the indigenous people that welcomed the white people, not only in what is today the U.S., but in South America and Canada and everywhere, because, like you say, they were the open people. They were welcoming to other people and were perfectly willing to share what they had, but the white people came in and stole and murdered and plundered and took the land, took the farmlands, and, you know, just took everything that the indigenous people had and forced them onto reservations, or in South America worked them to death in the mines, the silver mines and the gold mines. This is the history over and over again throughout what is now called the Americas.
Exactly, and it's a history that a lot of people in this country are ignorant about because it isn't taught in schools on a regular basis. The discovery of the Americas, even when I was, you know, going to school in elementary school and junior high, was seen as a big holiday, an actual celebration of Columbus. I work at a high school now, and now they're more introducing the whole concept of Via de la Raza and how Columbus was not exactly a hero, but they're still not painting him or Hernan Cortes or any of the other following, any of the following people that came and helped to destroy the culture and the people of this continent, they're still not painting them in the light that I feel they deserve to be painted, which is as extremely greedy criminals.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's starting to kind of shift a little bit in the sense of, well, okay, they weren't exactly heroes or, you know, entrepreneurs. A lot of them were criminals. A lot of them were what is called second sons, which means that they didn't stand to heir fortune or business or anything in Spain. They were mostly like second born sons. And they wanted a piece of the pie, and they wanted to be heroes, and they wanted to be celebrated. And they figured that the best way to do that was to come to the Americas and strike it rich with all our minerals and, you know, just basic food products that didn't exist in Europe before that time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's one of the, you know, one of the important aspects of history that is still not being taught in terms of Columbus Day or Thanksgiving or anything of that nature.
Yes, and I think that the reason why even there's somewhat of a shift that you're talking about is because of the movements of the native people, of the indigenous people, challenging and exposing who Columbus was as the perpetrator of genocide. So
exactly.
In that way, they're forced to do it. It's not because they got this realization. It's because there's demonstrations of indigenous people against Columbus and exposing and telling the truth about who he was. And I think that's very powerful and very telling, you know, of this period.
Indigenous people of South America and of Central America, Mexico, they all have this history, you know, that they carry with them. And to add insult to injury, aside from the oppression that continues today, they still have to, you know, kind of go through these struggles of, like, who are we going to be celebrating as heroes? And I think it was in South America where this whole movement first started, this whole pushback against celebrating this man that really caused the extinction of a lot of people, whether it was by his own hand or a ripple effect. If, you know, certain things in history hadn't taken place, then there would still be a lot more people and cultures and knowledge available to the world that has been wiped out. So I think this whole move really started, you know, within the continents, the three Americas, of just indigenous people pushing and pushing. And really, we were, in the United States, were a little bit late on the forefront when we finally, I guess, had our Chicano awakening during the Civil Rights Movement, where we started rediscovering our indigenous past and our indigenous cultures. So that's something that I think is also really relevant to point out, that this whole idea of Chicanismo also relates back to our indigenous roots and connects us to the entire continent.
Uhuru. And I think that it's really important for us as white people to acknowledge that Columbus was, yes, I'm sure he did have his own personal goals, but he was also part of the ongoing assault on Africa and on what's called the Americas and on Asia and the Arab world that was just beginning at the end of the 1400s and the 1500s with the enslavement of African people, with stealing the gold and silver of the Americas and bringing it to Europe. And this is what actually created, as Chairman O'Malley Shetela taught us, this is what created Europe. This is what created capitalism. This was the foundation of the wealth and power of U.S. and European imperialism. And so in that way...
Yeah, it completely did. If I could trace back, you know, one point in history where the birth of capitalism as we know it started, that would be the date. And I've argued this, you know, before in different academic settings, and people have always said, well, didn't people trade before then? And yes, absolutely, people did trade, but there's a difference between commerce and capitalism. And trade is actually another reason why the Americas is so connected. I mean, we traded I mean, it can be archaeologically shown and historically shown that that we've traded from as, and by we, I mean like the Mexican people, traded from as north as Oregon that we've been able to trace, and maybe even through Canada, all the way down to Peru and Chile, and really just the very tips of our continent. So, I mean, we were not, you know, small, tribal, ignorant nations. We were entirely huge empires.
Yes.
You know, that are connected to each other, that had contact with each other. And that's another way in which history fails us, because they don't explain that. They kind of like to paint the indigenous people of the Americas to be these extremely, like, mystical, superstitious people that had no idea who these Spanish people were. But we knew. We knew because we'd been in contact with other nations, because other people of other nations had come and fled from them to us.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't anything that, for example, the Aztecs didn't know, that the Mayans didn't know, because they'd already gone to Cuba, they'd already gone to Peru, you know?
Yes.
So it wasn't that we were ignorant of it. It was just, I think, part of it was nations warring with each other, that they, some people did fight with the whites, expecting the same kind of warfare code that we as indigenous people had, which is, if we are going to make a deal, then you're going to stick to it.
Mm-hmm.
And also the whole politics of conquest within Native nations was completely different than what the Europeans did with us. With Native nations, the way that conquest was carried over was, all the royalty and the nobles would be executed, and then the royalty coming in would take over those people. And the lives of the people wouldn't really change, because language wasn't imposed, because culture wasn't imposed, and instead the people that would come and conquer would take the language and the culture of the people that were conquered, as opposed to what they've done now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I think this is so true, that the history books portray the indigenous civilizations as isolated, like you're saying, mystical or isolated. And yet, in reality, there was an understanding of astronomy and science and the universe and even physics beyond a lot of what is understood today. You know,
oh, exactly.
In some of it. And it's so, you know, just part of trying to destroy a culture and conquer a people, as you're saying.
Yeah, and you know, our medical journal of the Aztec people was given to the king or queen, I forget, sorry, which one it was, of Spain, and it's still in their possession.
Wow.
And it was our medical journal with our various medicines and remedies for things as simple as a blister to things as complex as cancer.
Wow.
So it was really a journal of how to treat all these various maladies that the Spanish really wanted and used and continued to treasure. And they had people, you know, translating it, decoding it. And it was really, you know, part of our knowledge that they took and appropriated. And, you know, I'm sure a lot more mysteries would be solved if they hadn't burned our books as well.
Exactly. And I think some of what you're talking about is, of course, going on today with the theft of herbs and from the Amazon and you know, other medical understandings that indigenous people have in the Americas are used by the pharmaceutical companies to make billions
exactly,
of dollars.
Yeah, they get harvested, they get taken. Proper credit is never given. And these pharmaceutical companies come in and they patent the technology and make it unavailable for the public.
Well, I just want to say, first of all, we're going to take a little break, a couple of minutes break. We're going to give a few announcements about upcoming events. We're having a fantastic conversation, interview with Lucia Laguna of Union del Barrio. We're talking about the whole history of genocide of the indigenous people, the conquest by white power, by the Europeans, and the truth about what the indigenous cultures and civilizations were and still are. And we're going to be talking more with you when we get back about the struggle as it's going on today and the resistance and the struggle for liberation of indigenous people. So we'll be right back in just a couple of minutes with Lucia Laguna.
Ooh. You're listening to Reparations in Action, the show of the African People's Solidarity Committee here on UhuruRadio.com. And we have a lot going on right now in the work of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, Uhuru Foods, Uhuru Pies, and the work to support the economic development and social justice programs of the Uhuru Movement. Right now, the Uhuru Holiday Pie Campaign is really heating up and baking pies and getting out there in the community in Oakland, California, in St. Petersburg, Florida areas. But people can participate from anywhere in the Uhuru Pies campaign. If you want to get involved and become part of the 2010 Uhuru Pies team, you can call 800-578-5177 or email oakland@uhurupies.org. Or St. Pete, that's STPETE, at uhurupies.org. And you can go online to uhurupies.org to buy and donate, even if you're not in the Oakland or St. Petersburg areas, delicious Uhuru holiday pies, a 30-plus year tradition of supporting the African People's Education and Defense Fund through a delicious, all-natural, many organic ingredients used, community-based, volunteer-made Uhuru Holiday Pie, which is an economic development program of the Uhuru Movement. And to also support the programs of the African People's Education Defense Fund, right now you can bid on the 2010 Uhuru Holiday Online Auction, which is an auction of almost 100 gifts just in time for the holidays to support the African People's Education Defense Fund programs for sustainable black community economic development. And you can shop right online at apedf.org/auction. Just go to apedf.org/auction or go to apedf.org and just click on the middle where you see 2010 Uhuru Holiday Online Auction, and you can bid on any of these products and you'll get an email confirmation that you put your bid in, and that if anyone outbids you before the auction ends at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on December 6th, you'll find out and you get a chance to increase your bid. And all the proceeds from the bids on the winning items go to benefit the programs of the Uhuru Movement through the African People's Education and Defense Fund. It's a really exciting fundraiser and a way to get all your gifts for your family and friends for the holiday season. And finally, we want to invite everyone who's interested in taking a stand from the white community and becoming an ally of the struggle of African, Mexican, Indigenous, all oppressed peoples to win victory over their oppression and win back their resources, to come to the International Conference on White Solidarity with Black Power Beyond the Crisis of Imperialism this January 9th through 11th, 2011, in St. Petersburg, Florida, the city of African resistance. It's going to be held at the historic Uhuru House in St. Pete, and there's going to be a keynote presentation from Chairman Omali Eshetela, the leader of the Uhuru Movement, the chairman of the African Socialist International. It's a way to meet other like-minded people who want an end to all U.S. wars around the world and against the African and Mexican communities in this country, and really a chance to participate in the work of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. And Penny Hess, our chairwoman who hosts this show, will be also giving a presentation at this conference. It's really exciting, and it's from Sunday through Tuesday, January 9th through 11th, 2011. And for more info or to register, go to our website at apscuhuru.org. That's apscuhuru.org, or call 727-683-9949. And that's for the International Conference on White Solidarity with Black Power. And now back to Reparations in Action, the show of the African People's Solidarity Committee on UhuruRadio.com with your host, Penny Hess. Uhuru.
Uhuru Harrison, thank you. I can't wait to have some of those pies this year. And I know I'm going to be working on the bake. I'm going to be helping bake those pies in St. Petersburg next week. And you can do that too. So go to apscuhuru.org and sign up to volunteer to help produce these pies if you're in Oakland, California, or St. Petersburg, Florida. So I'm excited to get back with our guest, Lucia Laguna, member of Union de Barrio. We're talking about the fact that we are coming into the holidays of genocide, Thanksgiving, and we just had the Columbus Day. These are holidays that celebrate genocide. Lucia is talking about the struggle, the history, the true history of the indigenous people. And Lucia, welcome back, Uhuru. And I wanted to ask you, you talked about how the indigenous people had commerce, had trade routes with maybe between South America and you said into Oregon and Canada. And there is the understanding that I've learned from Union del Barrio that indigenous people are one people. We know that there's the Lakota who are in the South Dakota, based in the South Dakota of the U.S., who have on reservations, forced onto reservations in their own land, living on just the greatest poverty of any other group inside the U.S. and with a life expectancy of about 47 years old. And we also see indigenous people coming across the southern border, coming to reclaim their land and resources. So talk about, are there many indigenous people? Are there one people in this whole hemisphere?
Well, in this whole hemisphere, I believe that there are many different people, but we are one people, we are one blood. And how we can have that kind of, we're many but the same, is that we all have a shared history of struggle, a shared history of attempt of conquest, because I don't even like to call what happened in Mexico, even in the States, a conquest, because obviously we're still here.
Okay.
We're still here, our culture is still here, our foods are, a lot of what makes us, us, is still very prevalent. And I saw it going out on the town on Halloween in L.A., people were not in Halloween garb, they were in Dia de los Muertos garb. And I think that's something, you know, that is something that predates the Spanish conquest. That is something that we know has been around for like 5,000 years.
Wow.
So at least, I mean, that's like the oldest evidence that we have is 5,000 years. So, I mean, I really don't even like to call what happened to conquest, but we do have that shared history of struggle and of struggle to keep our identity, a struggle to keep on existing. And I think the fact that it's been over 500 years since this happened, and we're still here, and we're still strong, and we have, you know, in some small pockets of, you know, the academic world, we have American Indian Studies, we have the ASA Club, we have Chicano Studies. I think those things really serve as a testament that we're here to stay,
okay.
And that we're not going to give up. Yeah, we're not going to give up who we are. We're not going to give up our culture. And we're not going to give up everything that makes us a people in anytime soon. And I think that, thank you. And I think that that's really something very beautiful to look at. But we are one people in that sense because we do share all these similar experiences. And we do have this horrific history of having to fight to just stay on the map and to stay in the books. But at the same time, we are different in that each of our indigenous cultures has its own unique beauty. And to say that we're all one blanket term indigenous wouldn't be fair to all of us, you know, or any of us really. So I think that's another thing to also keep in mind, that that yes, an indigenous brother from Oaxaca and an indigenous brother in the Lakotas and an indigenous brother that's in Apache, we're all one people, but we also celebrate our differences as well as what makes us one.
Uhuru. Well, I appreciate what you're saying about it's not a conquest because the people are here, the people are strong, and the people will be free, and the people will get their land back. And it, you know, but it this whole attempt by white power to wipe out the people, but the people are here and the people are strong. And I want to say hooroo to that. I know that that the Southwest, what's called the Southwest of the U.S., California, mm-hmm. Texas, Arizona, where white people are scrambling to try to push out and keep the indigenous people, keep the Chicano people from coming in to the land that is really theirs. This land was stolen from Mexico. Can you tell us a little bit of history of that?
Okay, well, we've heard, I'm sure most of us have already heard, the one chant, "We didn't cross the border crossed us," which is definitely true for my stepdad's family, who's Yaqui, and are from Arizona, New Mexico, and for the Tarahumaras and for a lot of other indigenous groups. But it's also true for all of us, because as I said before, we had our trade routes, we had a migration going through all over the continent, and we moved freely. And it didn't really matter, you know, which nation we came from. We could go from one part of the continent to another over a period of 100 years. Sorry. And we'd still be considered part of those people, even if we did speak other languages. We'd eventually, you know, learn the language and just stay wherever there was food, wherever there was water. And it was really a means of survival, which is why, you know, even the Declaration of Human Rights says that, you know, being able to move for jobs, for survival, mm-hmm. is a human right. But that's something that we've always had. So this whole idea that, and argument that came from how the U.S. appropriated the land of Mexico, you have two arguments. One argument is from the U.S. side, which says, well, we paid for it fair and square, and it was a deal, it was a treaty that was signed, there was money that was given, and it was a fair deal. And then on the Mexican side, we say, well, the Santana guy was a corrupt president, one. Two, they caught him by himself and possibly inebriated, and three, they basically made him sign a treaty with a gun to his head. So that should not have ever been a legitimate trade.
Right.
And that's why we say that the land was stolen, because I don't know how anyone could ever see that as being fair and square. And I hear the argument of immigration always used in terms of like, oh, so someone sneaks into your house and starts eating your food and living there, you're going to let them. It's like, oh, okay, so why don't we just go to their house, point a gun to their head, and have them sign the lease to us? Right. And it's illegal appropriation. Mm-hmm. And now, ever since Israel forcefully took Palestine through very similar measures, right after that, it became illegal for land matters to be handled that way. So I just think that's also very opportunistic, but it's now internationally illegal and illegitimate for land to be taken
mm-hmm.
in that way, which it should have been from the beginning. But, yeah, I mean, you have this idea that the U.S. properly acquired these lands, and if you read any high school history book, any social studies book from the K-12, they don't really mention that part at all. They mentioned there was a war, and then they mentioned that because of this war, Mexico got this land. I mean, the U.S. got this land mm-hmm. that Mexico wasn't even using. That's how they like to, I think, also justify it, that there weren't any people really here, that they weren't using it appropriately. It was vast desert. It was a wild terrain. The U.S. basically did us a favor by taking that land because our country was too big anyway. And that's really the sense that is given in these history books that I think is also pretty ridiculous because, I mean, obviously people were living here. the Mexican, and that's another thing that needs to be clarified, the Mexican government and the Mexican people were different people. Mm-hmm. The Mexican government was made up mostly of Spaniards that were born in Mexico, called criollos. So they were the ones that lost the land. And they had, you know, a lot of missions. They had control over indigenous people. Mm-hmm. So even then, it wasn't fair under Mexican rule. But it was our land, and it all comes back to the original thing, that it's indigenous land. You know, Mexican land,
yes.
U.S. land, it's still indigenous land. And that's something that we can't stray away from.
Yes, Uhura. Well, talk a little bit more about the whole question of, quote, illegal aliens, and who are the real illegal aliens.
Yeah, that horrible term, illegal. Well, obviously now in the news there's been a lot of talk about, you know, how illegal aliens are taking jobs and benefits. And, I mean, apparently, according to Fox News, which I was watching yesterday out of morbid curiosity, there are all these benefits that undocumented people are taking. And, well, I don't know if they know this, but you can't really collect any benefits if you're undocumented. And having been around undocumented communities for a lot of my life, I know that there's really nothing for them to take. And in terms of what is considered illegal, who is considered illegal, the major picture of what an illegal person looks like is a Mexican. I mean, there has rarely been any emphasis on the undocumented Eastern European people that I've seen. There's been no emphasis on the undocumented Asian people. Yes, there's been deportations, but they have not been the targets. The targets right now are the Mexican people, are the Central American people, the South American people, and they make no distinction. They're all Mexicans, and they're all illegal. So that's been what the face of illegal has been. So these laws have been passed in Arizona that are up for debate in Florida, that have been also considered in Texas, and those are just a few of the other copycat states that I've heard of that want to implement the same kind of laws. They're not just anti-immigration laws. They're straight-up anti-Mexican laws. All of their propaganda, all of their imagery, when they're talking about an illegal alien, they always show the Mexican people. And then for them to turn around and say, oh, we're not racist, we're just against illegal immigration, well, that's a bunch of BS. And, you know, all you have to do is watch one of their ads or go to a comment, you know, news story that talks anything about undocumented people and read all the hatred that has been breeding out there for the Mexican people, and that's exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I mean, it's really clear, as I think Ron Gochez makes in another video of him challenging a white nationalist, one of the white border militias, saying that the real illegal aliens are the white people. I think he says most of the real illegal aliens are people that look more like that guy, not like the indigenous people whose land this is. And I think that, you know, that's a really important point. And the fact is that, like you're saying, this land belongs to and was stolen from the native people. So,
yes, exactly.
In his presentation at UCLA, Ron Gochez stated that yours is the northern front of the Latin American Revolution. So talk about that whole question and the relationship with Venezuela and Cuba. He talks about Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez and Evo Morales, and how does Unión del Barrio work with or see the unity with those governments and that movement happening right now?
Well, the governments of Venezuela and Bolivia and a lot of the leftist, you know, revolutions and spirit that has been rising up in North America, which is, you know, considered Latin America, even though they're not Romans. I guess it's really beautiful to think about this whole birth, this whole rebirth of socialism has a brown face. It isn't the socialism of you know, of Trotsky, of all these other, you know, all these other European thinkers. It's really rooted in an indigenous philosophy. So it is socialism, but it's not the socialism of Soviet Russia. It's not the socialism of, you know, communist China. It's a whole different breed of socialism, and that's something that we can really, as Unión del Radio, that we really do look to in terms of guidance and also in solidarity, because we want to have that same kind of indigenous unity and uprising all over the continent, honestly. So when we see, for example, Evo Morales or Hugo Chavez talking about the nation, about how they're nationalizing all these formerly privatized markets, about how this is going back to the people, and how the people have a say in their government, like an actual say. They have small communities, and those small communities report to bigger communities, and it really is very participatory. And you talk to anybody in those countries about politics, and they know what's going on, as opposed to in this country, where they only know what is allowed to them by you know, national news media.
Yes.
And I do say allowed because I really do feel that a lot of information is purposely made inaccessible. So we see these revolutions rising up in Latin America, and we definitely feel that we are part of it, both because some of our members have gone over there, have built relationships, and also because ideologically that's where we are as well. So when we say we're the Northern Front of this movement that goes all throughout the Americas, we absolutely mean it. I mean, obviously, we're not at the same level as they are, but we would one day like to be. We want to work toward being one united front mm-hmm. against capitalism, against imperialism, and against the oppression and repression of our people. So that's what we mean, that we are, you know, the Northern Front, and we would love more than anything, of course, to see Mexico join ALBA, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that seems not that it's not very close anytime soon. But if it can take over the whole continent, we're definitely going to be right there with our brothers and sisters. And even now, we're still right there, and there's still, you know, various committees that deal with the question of, you know, what we're doing internationally with these groups.
Uh-huh.
We do feel very connected, and we're not out here, you know, in LA and in San Diego on our own. We do feel that we're part of something a lot bigger than us, and a lot bigger than the United States and Mexico, a lot bigger than, you know, really anything that we've felt in the past, you know, 27 years that we've been around.
Oh, whoa.
It really is a resurgence of a movement, and we're definitely a part of that in all movements that work toward liberating our people.
Uhuru, it's very exciting to see, and see the challenge to the U.S. and to all of the things that the U.S. takes for granted that it can do. And it's got this growing movement south of the stolen border that's challenging it on every front, and that is powerful. And it seems like in terms of what's happening in Mexico right now, that on the one hand, that the U.S. is really, no doubt, working in so many ways to destabilize that country. And at the same time, there seems to be various movements going on in the country. Could you just say a little bit about that, about what is happening in Mexico at the moment? Because we hear so much you know, we don't know what is true about what is being said. And
did you repeat the question? I had a really hard time hearing
you. Oh, I'm sorry. I was saying that
few things that you said.
If you could just, it seems like it's hard. One of the things that it's hard to know is exactly what is happening in Mexico right now, because we don't know to what extent what we get on the news is right. And could you just say a little bit about, it seems like there are struggles of the people going on, legitimate struggles for liberation going on inside of Mexico. Can you comment on that?
Okay, I'm so sorry. I'm having a really hard time hearing you. It's like
okay.
You're breaking up, but...
Okay.
Really,
that's fine.
Do you want me to do comments on what?
If you can, just for a minute, if you can hear me, just talk about a little bit about what's happening in Mexico right now.
Oh, yeah, very sad story. Right now in Mexico, there's been, ever since the election of Calderón, there's been a war on drugs and a war on violence. And what that has actually produced is more violence and more control of the drug cartels. This is something that has been going on for a really long time, but it's gotten worse in the last few years. And part of the reason that we feel it's gotten worse is because of the Calderón administration itself. Now, Mexican politics have always been corrupt. There's always been actual, like, criminals and, you know, multimillionaire gang members that have been pulling the strings of a lot of Mexican legislation. And this goes back to when Mexico first got its independence from Spain and even from before then, ever since the fall of our people's empires. Excuse me. Why I think why it's gotten worse lately is because the economy in Mexico has suffered even more ever since the passage of NAFTA. And it's just been a growing and growing rate of poverty of people unable to make not even a good living, a survival living.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, common folk, good people, that wouldn't otherwise do this, are forced between, well, do I migrate to the United States or do I join a cartel? And sadly, a lot of young people have chosen to go the criminal route. And not just, you know, small thievery, but becoming drug mules, which, you know, pays really well. And then it leads to being more involved in the cartel. So when a lot of people start as mules and they start going up in the ranks, and they recruit family members and, you know, people that would otherwise be having good jobs, or be working land, or be going to school, that's not an option for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, it does go back to NAFTA. It does go back to the fact that Mexico isn't in charge of its own resources. That what they export is a lot more expensive than what they import. So they have cheap products. Their own national products have gone down in terms of price, but their value is still really high on the market. And really, Mexico has gotten the shorter end of that stick.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not the lease meant for it to be that way or not, that's how it's worked out. So free trade is not something that has worked out for the Mexican people.
Right.
And things that we used to survive on and depend on are gone. So
right.
I really think that is what has given rise to the cartels, that people that would have otherwise maybe even migrated and now because of the situation here, they don't want to.
This has gone so fast, Lucia. Can you hear me? This has gone so fast. I didn't realize it's 2:00 and we have to end this show, but we want to have you on again. Thank you so much. Uhuru.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate, you know, the interest and being able to get the truth out there.